16, 17-year-old, 18-year-olds now, where the Holocaust and the Second World War is like talking to my parents and my grandparents about the Napoleonic period. The Second World War has become increasingly historicized. It's not the touchstone that it once was for certainly younger generations. And I think that partly explains why parts of the far right vote in Europe is in some places actually a young vote.
Welcome to A History of Xenophobia, from the gold mines to the rise of the far right today. My name is Ariel Glynn, and I'm the host of this History Hub podcast series. History Hub is based at the School of History at University College Dublin in Ireland. You can find a huge range of podcasts and videos showcasing historical research on our website, historyhub.ie. You can also follow us on various social media, and if you want to get in contact with us about the series, please email info@historyhub.ie. Dr. Joe Mohol is a historian, journalist and writer and the director of research at Hope Not Hate, the UK's largest anti-fascism and anti-racism organisation. He completed his PhD in history at Royal Holloway, University of London, which provided the basis for his excellent book, British Fascism After the Holocaust, published by Routledge. He's a co-author of the International Alternative Right with colleagues from Hope Not Hate, which also came out with Routledge. Most recently, Joe wrote Drums in the Distance, Journeys into the Global Far Right with Icon Books. Joe writes regularly for the print media in Britain, including for The Guardian, Independent and New Statesman, and appears regularly on broadcast media, including the BBC News at 10, Radio 4's Today programme, The Moral Maze and Channel 4 News, among others. He has worked on numerous documentaries, including Undercover in the Alt-Right, which was broadcast on Amazon Prime. Today we will talk to Joe about post-war British fascism, the rise of the far right more recently, and the alt-right, topics that Joe has covered extensively in his publications and his work with Hope Not Hate. So, Joe, thanks a million for agreeing to talk to us today. So, maybe to start back with your doctoral work, which was, as I mentioned, in history, and you focused on British fascism after the Holocaust. So, you wrote in this book entitled British Fascism After the Holocaust that, quote, "If fascism did not die with the gas chambers, it's likely that nothing will kill it, revealing its ability to change and adapt and the persistence of prejudice and hatred," unquote. So, how did fascists who remained active in Britain after the Second World War justify their politics after the horrors of the Holocaust came to light?
That was kind of the key question of the whole project, right, of the whole PhD was, I was fascinated with the idea, how is it that anyone, once the news of the Holocaust breaks, could still be interested in fascism or still stick with their ideology? It seemed like an anathema. And so when I started to dig into those early post-war fascists, I mean, as the news of the Holocaust starts to break in Britain in the kind of towards the end of the war, you do see a variety of reactions. There are some kind of pre-war fascists who turn around and say, I had no idea that this is where the kind of logical conclusion of this politics was going to end up. And you do see some of them fade away. You see other ones that just kind of obfuscate a little bit and turn around and say, yeah, but that was German fascism. You know, we're talking about Britain, etc. But lots of British fascists during the war were interned under a thing called Defence Regulation 18B, where they were kind of rounded up and kept in kind of prisons or kind of prison of war camp types of things in the UK. And in some ways, these offered like hothouses, where you had these individuals that had been in things like the British Union of Fascists or the Imperial Fascist League, found themselves all in the same place in this camp, and they became little education units. And so some of these people either continued with their fanaticism or were even became more fanatical during the war. And so as the news of the Holocaust breaks and a lot of these activists are back out on the streets and we start to see the activism reemerge more significantly after the war, these ones are kind of left with a crisis or a question they have to answer, especially the ones that were fanatically anti-Semitic, who traditionally believed that the Jews ran the world and that the Jews were supposedly all-powerful. How is it that the Jews can be all-powerful and run the world? And then in their parlance, would let the Holocaust happen to them. That there seemed to be some sort of paradox there. And for some people, it was too much of a paradox, as I say, and they turned around and said, well, we must have been wrong. But for a lot of the British fascists, it was much easier to turn around and say, the only way we can explain this is if the Holocaust didn't happen. And you start to see the birth of Holocaust denial really, really early in the UK, before the end of the war's even over. In fact, by kind of 1945, 1946, all of the tropes that we come to think of later on with the famous Holocaust deniers of the 70s and 80s are there, even down to these images and videos that we're seeing were being faked by Hollywood, you know, producers and all these sorts of things. So for some people, they genuinely believe that there was no way that this all-powerful group of people, as in the Jews, would have allowed this to happen to them. So this must be some sort of fabrication. And in some of them, it was a fabrication designed to create guilt around the world, but also to create the state of Israel. So some of them went that way. Some people were absolutely fanatical and believed it. And other ones, I think it was much more cynical. So there were some people that were anti-Semitic enough that they actually didn't mind the fact that the Holocaust had happened. You know, there was a guy called Arnold Lees, who was perhaps the most anti-Semitic British fascist ever, who said publicly, the Holocaust didn't happen, but I wish it had happened. So you kind of get that absolutely ludicrous, extreme position there. But for other ones, they just started to realise that if they were ever going to be able to relaunch this ideology, which they dedicated their lives to, in the light of the Holocaust, in the light of the news of the Holocaust being increasingly well known around the UK and around the world, they would have to remove that kind of stain on its reputation, which demanded that they remove the Holocaust. To rebuild fascism, you had to remove the Holocaust.
It's incredible how, you know, you talk about these conspiracy theories, about doubting pictorial evidence, blaming Allied bombing, typhus, even arguing Hitler's ignorance of crimes. You know, but that you said, you know, despite this, it survives. You know, one of the most significant arguments you make in that book is that understanding British fascism in the immediate post-war period is really important for understanding the later development of the far right in the 1970s and 1980s. Why is that?
I think a lot of the literature will either kind of say fascism is this kind of time-shackled 1930s, 1940s thing that is either specifically German or Italian or even time-bound into that war, and fascism dies in 1945. Mussolini's strung up. Hitler's dead, that's it. You know, and so what's happening post-war is something separate. British fascism, because of course Britain doesn't have the destruction of those movements in the same way that happens on the continent because of the war, there is an unbroken thread in the UK. It becomes very, very difficult for those historians that want to argue that fascism should either be divided into two distinct periods, pre-war and post-war, or those historians that say there is no such thing as post-war. It becomes much harder when you look at the British fascist movement, because when is the break? Where is the break? The people that are relaunching the movement in the post-war period are the same individuals that were active in the pre-war period. The ideas often that they were espousing and the politics that they were pushing was identical in many cases to the pre-war period. So there is no break in that UK scene, which then questions the idea of this kind of pre-post dichotomy a little bit. And because of that unbroken thread, there was individuals that were active in the 1940s that were central figures in the 1970s and 80s in the UK scene. And in fact, there was figures only just a few years ago. You know, I'm thinking of a guy called John Bean specifically, who was involved in kind of post-war fascist movements that were still around in the British far right into the 2000s. And so you can trace the lineage of both ideology and individuals from the 1940s, when it is, of course, a much smaller, you know, these groups are small, tiny, fringe and fanatical, into the period when we see the rise of things like the National Front and into the British National Party in the 80s. A lot of the individuals cut their teeth. Those key players that became the leaders in the 1970s often began their activism in the 1940s and early 1950s in these small fringe groups. That's where they got their education. In some senses, that was the swamp that these mosquitoes later came out of.
You know, several times in that book, you maybe question the use of neo-fascism. You know, that it wasn't anything new. You know, okay, circumstances had changed, but what these people and some of the organizations involved were doing was very similar to what they had done before the Second World War.
Yeah, again, for those that use the term neo, and of course, you know, and some lots of people use it in kind of common parlance, which I get, and I'm sure, you know, I do have it, hope not hate it at times, but certainly when we're looking at the movement of the late 1940s and in the UK, Oswald Mosley comes back and we see the birth of the union movement in the post-war period, for example, there are some ideological shifts slightly. There are some shifts, you know, and the context, of course, is very, very different, 1930s versus 1950s. But the individuals are the same, the hatreds are the same, the ideologies are often the same. And the continuities to me seem to outweigh the differences in terms of the movement itself, which begs the question, why are we using the term neo? And that's not just in the UK, of course. You know, I think I'd ask similar questions about, you know, the MSI in Italy versus Mussolini in the pre-war period. And there's lots of examples where I think the continuities are really, really strong. And it just seems too convenient because the war stopped, that we then have this kind of binary thing where we say, okay, this was fascism and this is neo-fascism or neo-Nazism, when the continuities seem stronger than the differences.
I remember you use Roger Griffin's ideal type, you know, to maybe as a definition, and there are a lot of competing definitions, but, you know, he states that generic fascism is a genus of political ideology whose mythic core is, in its various permutations, is a palingenetic form of populist ultranationalism. Can you, for people maybe not au fait with some of that language, you know, try to explain that in more simpler terms?
Yeah. I mean, I liked his definition. I mean, as you say, like, this is there was just an unending number of books and articles written. Kind of, I mean, there's a whole school of field of study, isn't there, trying to work out how we define fascism. And what I liked about his is that it isn't time shackled. You know, there are lots of the kind of definitions that are competing to that often talk very specifically about things like either uniforms or iconography or specific time periods or regimes. And I think that's unhelpful if you're a historian like myself that believes that the post-war fascism exists. You need a general definition. And Griffin's is useful in a few ways. Palingenetic populist ultranationalism, if you take them each, like palingenetic, this sense of rebirth, right? This notion that the nation is in crisis and that the people need to be reborn, or the nation needs to be reborn in some sense. So it's a broad idea that we see in all fascist movements pre and post-war, the sense of rebirth. Populism, you know, and I kind of use the widely accepted definition of Casmuda, the splitting of the country into a pure people and a corrupt elite. Often the pure people seem to be being used by the fascist elite, you might argue, but this is this idea that people are pure in some sense and they are being corrupted by this nasty, corrupt elite. And that elite doesn't necessarily have to be the kind of traditional elites that run the country. Often this elite, of course, in fascist senses, may be some supernatural, transnational, international Jewish conspiracy or whatever, but they are corrupting the people. So, nationalism is that idea that it's not just that the patriotism is that there is something exceptional, different, or specifically, you know, exceptional about the nation. And of course, with fascism, depending on the elements or the far right, which bits of the movement you're talking about, that nation is sometimes defined in a racial sense, sometimes in a cultural sense or geographic sense. And so when you tie them together, the nation is in crisis. The pure people, need to rise up and be listened to. And the nation that you're talking about, either a racial or cultural one, is ostensibly the kind of, there is something special, different or exceptional about it. When you combine them, that has a lot of the mechanisms by which fascism essentially energizes populations.
What fascinated me about your book was how you highlighted that the British fascism was surprisingly slow when it came to seeing opportunities provided to them by non-white immigration. So in your most recent book, Drums in the Distance, Journeys into the Global Far Right, you describe how the British far right have always sought out an other to, quote, secure wider public support and gain entry into the mainstream of domestic politics. But so after the war, the British far right was still obsessed with Jews, which only served to isolate them further from the mainstream, is what you maintain. But as public hostility to non-white immigration grew, something we touched on with Liz Bentner in a previous episode, which when we discussed Enoch Powell's infamous 1968 Rivers of Blood speech, it was the far right belatedly shifted its attacks onto the new arrivals. So it's amazing that they weren't leading, they were following kind of public opinion or certain parts of the public on this, and they didn't realize the kind of the benefits that this could bring them, you know, that and this is a really important shift as well in, you know, we're talking about fascism and the far right and this kind of turn away from focusing only on Jews, and, you know, it's still there, it's still in the background, but kind of non-white immigration and immigration more generally is something that has, you know, created a lot of support for them. So what benefits did it bring when they began to look at immigration more so than kind of Jewish tropes.
Yeah, I mean, and this was one of the big shocks, right? Was going through all of the kind of sitting in the Vienna Library in London and going through all of the fascist newspapers I could find, and Hope Not Hate has an archive of old fascist newspapers, and of course, you know, famously, kind of the Windrush arrives. You know, people talk about this as the gateway into modern Britain, the arrival of non-white immigrants from the West Indies, and of course, you had larger scale immigration from the subcontinent as well, which is when, you know, my family came over. And I just thought, you know, lots of the mainstream newspapers had front page stories about Windrush arriving and people, you know, black people from the West Indies arriving. And there was almost no mention of it in most of the British fascist newspapers. They're still talking about either kind of Holocaust denial stuff, or it's about Jewish, pernicious Jews took us into the war. And really, actually, I mean, especially in Oswald Mosley's newspapers, most of the conversation about black people in those early years of in the post-war period was commenting on other groups in society complaining about the arrival of these people, especially, sadly enough, the trade union movement saying that, you know, a lot of the debates there about work, etc. And so, yeah, they were still kind of obsessed with this discussion about Jews, and they weren't. I mean, of course, I'm not saying these people weren't wildly racist against new communities that were arriving, but for them, of course, the Jews ran the world, and then there was just these people that, you know, I won't use the language they were Jews, but these people were arriving, and, you know, they were an inconvenience, they didn't want them, but the real enemy, of course, was this kind of pernicious global forces. That begins to change, I think, when you start to see into the 1950s, when you start to see wider societal discontent about immigration growing, and wider societal racism and governmental racism, etc. And you're absolutely right to use that thing where too often, I think, and I think it's a convenient idea that the far right are the ones that lead society in racism. But actually, I think they reflect it quite often. And a great example of that is the Notting Hill riots that happened in race riots in 1958, where, you know, actually groups like the British Union of Fascists, or so the Union Movement and Mosley's groups and the League of Empire Loyalists and these sorts, were actually responding. They were turning up afterwards. And I think it was quite convenient to say, oh, yeah, no, it wasn't a societal issue. It was the far right whipping up tensions. And actually, most of the evidence, I think, suggests that it was the far right looking and realizing how much societal racism there was and shifting tack and shifting towards it. As I say, none of that means that they weren't always racist. But one of the things you're right to kind of point out is that in the post-Holocaust age, banging on constantly about anti-Semitism and Jews was a pretty fruitless task. Doesn't mean there wasn't wide societal anti-Semitism in the UK in the post-war period. There patently was. There was, you know, with the creation of Israel in 1948, there was riots in the UK, etc. There was still widespread anti-Semitism. But it was a hard political program to be selling, right, when people had seen those videos of bodies being pushed into bodies bulldozed into pits and stuff, to be still trumpeting this anti-Semitic line. Whereas talking about black people coming from the West Indies and Asian people coming from India and the subcontinent, that was a route into mainstream discourse. That was something that was widely believed. That was stuff that was being propagated from mainstream newspaper outlets, etc. And the far right throughout the post-war period, as I say, often they follow rather than lead, and they turn around and they pick the target that they think is most likely to gain them traction in more mainstream places. And so we do see a shift towards them talking much more about people of colour in the 1950s and 1960s. Later on, we see the shift towards talking much more overtly just about Muslims, etc. You know, during various periods in the 80s and 90s, they would be talking about gay men. Today, they talk about the trans community. It doesn't mean they don't hate all of these people at the same time. And it doesn't mean that actually at the core of their politics, often, especially within the more extreme ends, the fascist end of the movements, there is a continuity of anti-Semitism at its core. But the thing that they talk about most publicly and openly externally is what they think is most likely to allow them to engage with mainstream people and recruit individuals. And that shifts through time.
We spoke to Ruth Wodak, the linguist, you know, about her work on the far right as well. And she, you know, talks about how these anti-Semitic attitudes are still there, but they're often communicated in code. And as you said, you know, there's more explicit mention of different immigrant groups because they think that's what generates their popularity or helps to generate more popularity. But you mentioned there the 1980s, the 1990s. So you have the National Front in the 70s that is much more outwardly racist and focusing on non-white immigration, for instance. But as kind of happened in the 60s, the Conservative Party in Britain also kind of wades in on this and maybe gets rid of the challenge from the far right by embracing this topic itself, are becoming more and more restrictive and hostile in many ways. In the late 1970s, the National Front is kind of hoodwinked a bit by Margaret Thatcher, who kind of comes out questioning the level of immigration, and I think she uses the word swamped. But you say in the 1980s, the British National Party come to prominence and they muscle in on the political space previously occupied by the National Front. But you observed that, quote, it remained a party of the streets best known for provocative and confrontational marches, unquote. But then in the 1990s, it made an electoral breakthrough in kind of local elections in East London. And then in the late 1990s, Nick Griffin took over as leader and became, in your words, quote, the great moderniser of the BNP, the man who led the British far right out of the wilderness and into the European Parliament, unquote. Can you tell us a bit about that modernisation of the BNP? Because even before we started recording, I was mentioning in Ireland how the far right is still kind of very much the extreme right, that it hasn't made this transition yet to the radical right. But under Nick Griffin, the BNP made this this transfer, something that we've touched on elsewhere in the podcast series, about going from kind of extreme on the street violence protests to trying to put forward a more sanitized image that would allow it to gain some kind of foothold in electoral politics.
Yeah, so as you say, you know, the National Front kind of peaks out in 1979. They stand 303 candidates, but the rug essentially is pulled under them a little bit, as you say, from Thatcher's swamp speech. And then there's all these internal machinations and you know, the minutiae we don't need to get into. But the British National Party and the far right is basically, through much of that period, is the 80s and 70s and 80s, is talking about marching and growing. It's about dominating the streets. It's about taking back communities, etc. In 1993, the BNP get an electoral breakthrough in the Isle of Dogs in London, and a guy called Derek Beacon. And that, when we talk about like learning the lessons of who they're going to target, you know, they target an East End community where you'd had immigration into that community, especially kind of like Bangladeshi and Asian immigration into that community. And they went big on that, and they exploited kind of societal anger or community anger in that space. In some senses, Nick Griffin, as you kind of quote there, is the person that takes this rag bag of steel toe capped, you know, bleached jeans, skinheaded movement. Those people were always still there, but he takes that batch of people, puts them into suits, and the movement turns into the point where they've got two MEPs, one member of the London Assembly, and I think 64 odd councillors by 2010. Which makes the British National Party the most successful electoral far-right party Britain's ever seen, more so even than Mosley was, in some senses. But in many ways, he's looking across the continent. The British National Party's modernisation project has to be looked at in the context of what we're seeing in the continent, most clearly with Le Pen, not Marine, who we now have, but her father, and the modernisation process that were happening in lots of European far-right parties at a similar time. And in fact, we had the European elections just a few days ago. A number of the parties that won really quite largely or did okay in the European elections, far-right parties, would have traditionally, at this period we're talking about in the 80s and 90s, we're talking about kind of neo-Nazi groups or Nazi groups and fascists and Holocaust deniers and anti-Semites. And now we're talking about them having, you know, dozens of seats in the European Parliament. Sweden Democrats would be another great example of a party that went on that modernisation trajectory. Le Pen or National Rally, as it now is, in the Front National before, that went on that. Vlaams Belang. There's lots of these parties. And so Griffin was certainly looking across at the continent and this idea that was turning around and saying, perhaps there is an electoral route to power. This isn't just about the streets. There is a way that we can modernise in a way, which means essentially they started to present a view to the world or a vision to the world that was very different to their core politics. You know, as I said, they were talking much less about, you know, Nick Griffin was always talking about the Holocaust and white power and this sort of stuff. And they moderates the tone, moderates the language that he's using, and it moderates the image of the party eventually, where they turn around and say, actually, we're just like you. We're just normal people that care about the same things that you care about. We're concerned about our country. We're just good patriots here. And that modernization is a modernization of tone and rhetoric rather than reality. The core of the British National Party, even through into 2010 at its peak, the core of its ideology remains a small number of people that in some senses, as they would say, knew the truth, which remained fanatical anti-Semites. They were the ones that had swastikas under the bed. But that process was remarkably successful, less successful than some of its European counterparts for various reasons. But it was successful to the point where we took a movement that was marching in places like Lewisham and facing kind of street level anti-fascist resistance in places like Lewisham and demonstrations around the country. And it took it into council chambers around the country. It took it into the European Parliament and it took it into the London Assembly, which things that would have been almost incomprehensible in the 70s and 80s previously.
Yeah, in Drums in the Distance, for instance, you talk about Hope Not Hate's work in 2000, 2010s and the success they met with in stopping the BNP. But you also talk in a chapter about the far right in Britain in that book about how the UK, UKIP, was a very different beast to the BNP and, quote, one that had a far more important effect on British politics than any far right party before then had managed. Can you explain this to us? You know, you talk about their electoral success, nearly 4 million votes in 2015, their centrality in the Brexit debates, their poster, the famous kind of poster with Nigel Farage in front of, during the Brexit debates. So how were they different to BNP? And can you tell us a bit about the impact they had?
Yeah, so it almost seems odd looking back to those debates. I mean, so when the British National Party imploded in 2010 and the elections, there was disaster. There was kind of a massive anti-fascist mobilisation across the country. And that was supposed to be the moment the BNP were going to break through. And they didn't break through. They lost all their seats in Dagenham. And in the years that followed, they lost in Burnley and Stoke and until, the party barely exists anymore. And I remember kind of sitting in meetings with our fellow kind of anti-fascists at Hope Not Hate. And we were saying, do we talk about UKIP? We knew that UKIP had lots of racists in it. We knew that it was xenophobic in some ways. We knew that it was nativist in its politics. But it wasn't fascist. And Nigel Copsey, in his book on the history of British anti-fascism, kind of says this was a bit of an existential crisis for the anti-fascist movement. Now, of course, looking back, it just seems like the obvious thing. The BNP finished, we'd go for UKIP. But it really wasn't. It was a big discussion because the groups like the British National Party were pressed, as I mentioned, that unbroken thread. Previously the National Front, previously the Union Movement, previously the BUF, there was a continuity of people and ideas that were at their core, they were fascist, even if they'd moderated their tone and language. At their core, these were fascists. UKIP, in many ways, didn't come directly out of that tradition. They weren't the next step along. And the English Defence League also didn't come directly out of that tradition. And so it was something of a debate to argue whether or not, well, if they're not essentially fascist, is it the job of the anti-fascist movement? And partly because they didn't come out of that explicit tradition of fascism, partly because they didn't come out of that, meant they were much more successful. It was much harder for groups like Hope Not Hate, but journalists and researchers, etc. There was fewer swastikas under the bed, if we use that analogy, in the way that there was. One of the big tactics that movements had used was turning around and saying, this person who's standing for the British National Party, here is a picture of them with a swastika. That was happening much less frequently when we come to UKIP, which meant the toxicity of the party was less. They were talking about more mainstream issues. They already had a much more moderate, respectable image. And they were much more likely or much more engaged with from mainstream journalists, mainstream politicians. They were on television much more. They were on radio much more because they were, in some senses, unfortunately, perceived not to be beyond the cordon sanitaire, not to be beyond the pale. And so they were much more successful in that sense. And they, if we'd had a European-style electoral system, the millions of votes that they received would have ended up in a sizable showing, not just in the European Parliament, of course, but also in our own Parliament in the UK, which didn't happen. But in some ways, despite you not winning MPs and those sorts of things, they were having a seismic effect on British politics more broadly, on the particular issues that they were most interested in. Of course, there's the obvious one, which is Brexit. But more broadly, a huge amount of the driver of the support and interest in that party around Brexit was about immigration. And they're a really great example about this porous wall between what we call the mainstream and the radical right or the mainstream and the far right. It's not a solid wall. It is a porous wall where ideas and individuals move back and forth across it. And UKIP were very, very successful about pulling the centre ground of British politics right on issues like immigration, identity, integration. And of course, in some sense, the European Union, it's more complex. But whether or not that was the Labour Party then talking about British jobs for British workers, or whether or not it was the subsequent radicalization of the Conservative Party, or whether or not it was David Cameron calling the Brexit election journey, a lot of that was, of course, because of the gravitational pull of the UKIP, which hung off the right of politics. And UKIP shouldn't be understood as like, or the far right more broadly, but UKIP certainly shouldn't be understood as a tumour that hangs off the body politic. And if you just cut it off, everything else is fine. It was a gangrenous limb, is a better analogy, which it was poisoning the body politic, but it was part of it. And I think that's why it was so successful.
You also talk in Drums in the Distance about the European far right. And I think there's parallels there with UKIP, what you just said there, because, you know, maybe the people who are voting for UKIP look very different, you know, can appear very different to those who had supported BNP or who were prominent in BNP. And you saw the same thing. You talk about going to a Pegida protest in Dresden in November 2015, and you wrote that the crowd was overwhelmingly made up of very respectable-looking people, usually in couples and overwhelmingly middle-aged. And as a result, you said this was much more scary than the violent far-right events that you had seen in England, because it was families rather than skinheads who were attending. Can you tell us a bit, you know, we did discuss Pegida and the kind of AfD, the rise of AfD, and how it was actually focusing on bailouts initially, you know, and the economy, and then kind of switched. But can you tell us a bit about the rise of the radical right in Europe and their apparent move into the mainstream more recently, you know, along similar enough trajectory to UKIP, although, as you mentioned, UKIP didn't gain many MP seats because of the electoral system in Britain, whereas in Ireland and Germany and elsewhere, the proportional representation, it's a bit different, that they can, you know, the equivalent, I think there would have been something like 15% of the parliament in Britain would have been UKIP if it had been a PR system. You know, you talk about the crumbling of the anti-fascist consensus in Europe, the diminution of traditional parties, the economic crisis that I've just mentioned, and then the so-called crisis, refugee crisis in 2015.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think when we look at both the rise of the European far right or radical right over the last 20, 30 years, but also I think you can probably actually extrapolate it out a little bit further to the global networks, you know, whether or not we're talking, you know, Modi in India, Trump in, you know, America, Bolsonaro in Brazil. There is as many differences between all of these countries in Europe and around the world as there are similarities. But I do think there's a couple of commonalities which allow us to say, why is it that, you know, in 1991 or 90, you know, the end of the Cold War, when the wall crumbles in Berlin, you know, Francis Fukuyama is talking about the end of history. He's talking about the kind of the liberal democracy being the final form of government. This kind of, now it just seems absolutely absurd looking back on it. But there was that sense that, yeah, liberal democracy had won. And so how is it that just two or three decades later, we're in a situation where we had European elections last week and, you know, a quarter of the vote went to far-right parties and, you know, nearly 2 billion people at various times at one point were living under radical right or far-right governments. And I think there's a couple of things. I really like Dan Stone, the historian, the Holocaust historian, who wrote a great book called, you know, What Happened to That? It's like History of Post-War Europe. And he talks about saying, actually, a lot of the post-war debates, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, a lot of the post-war discussions, in some senses, were kind of, there was a fire blanket over them throughout the Cold War period, right? In the West, anti-fascism was like a national myth in countries like Britain, etc. But across Western Europe, it was a national myth. In the East, it was obviously an instrumentalized tool of the state. But it meant that a lot of the debates and discussions were kind of, there was a fire blanket over them. And he argues that essentially that fire blanket is lifted in the early 90s. And a lot of those forces and discussions that have been suppressed start to peak out. So we have those kind of long historical reasons that we've seen the rise. Then we throw in long, whether or not it's things like the legacies of colonialism, racism, etc. Those are all bubbling in the pot. Then, of course, we also have the increasing influx of globalization for all of its good things, you know, international integration, as in some senses we've seen national disintegration. So there's the issues around globalization, neoliberal economic hegemonial politics across large parts of the world or large parts of the Western world, again, has created some winners, but it's created lots of losers as well. So there's all of these long-term factors which are creating a sense that ostensibly in large parts of the populations of lots of these countries, the status quo is not working for them. You know, it's not, and so to turn around to them and say, just stick with the mainstream parties, is a pretty unappealing argument when the lives have become to stagnate, the welfare consensus is starting to crumble, what the people expected from the state throughout most of the post-war period is no longer being offered to them. And then I think that we have these trigger events, which I think are really important for understanding where we are today. Some of them are things like we have to take into account. It's not just about economics. The impact of the terrorist attacks, whether or not we talk about 9/11, but Islamist terror attacks, the ones in Paris, the ones in Germany, the ones in 7/7 in London, but 9/11, etc. Certainly not just the terror attacks, the way they were discussed and weaponized by not just the far right, but we're talking about mainstream politicians, mainstream media outlets that essentially rapidly normalized Islamophobic narratives. Collective responsibility for Muslim communities and migrant communities in Europe became normalized really, really quickly. You mentioned, the so-called migrant crisis, a very similar phenomenon whereby the reaction from, again, this is about the mainstream legitimizing far-right politics. The way that kind of period discussion was happening was extraordinarily negative and harmful. And again, it normalized the politics that opened the door to these far-right parties. 2009 financial crisis, again, is really fundamentally important. Again, so many people's lives were made worse off, both by the crisis and the subsequent austerity that followed it. You know, there is a whole generation of people, me included, that doesn't remember barely a period that is pre either economic crisis or pre-austerity. It goes back. There's, kids have finished university that were born during this sort of period. And so all of this kind of comes together to create this sense that why would you stick with either social democratic parties or centre-right conservative parties when lives are not getting better? And this was something we would see at Hope Not Hate when you knocked on doors in Dagenham or Burnley or Stoke in the UK, or if you went to the outskirts of Paris, or if you went to Dresden and you spoke to people from Pegida, you went to these places and they turned around and said, look, I'm in my 30s, I can't buy a house, I live with my parents, there's no hospitals, there's no schools, there's no jobs. They're consuming a media narrative about Muslims and immigrants on a day-to-day basis, which is pernicious and negative. And then parties turn up and turn around and say, we can fix all of this for you very, very easily. And they offer super simple answers to all of these complex phenomena. And it's extraordinarily appealing. And the part of the issue is that much of mainstream politics, whether or not that's liberal democratic or social democratic or centre-right parties, their response to the rise of these far-right parties was to try to mimic them or echo them, rather than try to defend the institutions of liberal democracy or to defend the rights of the communities they're supposed to represent and deal with the material needs of these people. They ran right and legitimized further the far right in terms of these issues. And then it becomes this almost runaway train. And so when you put all these things together, you can go from 30 years ago where there'd always been far right parties in Western Europe, of course, throughout the whole post-war period. But the speed with which you start to see this rise to the point where now it almost seems normal. You know, we were saying before, you look at the electoral results of the European Union just recently, and the conversation in lots of the media is relief. You know, I think the BBC called Meloni and the Brothers of Italy doubling their vote. They called it reassuringly as predictable, rather than horrifyingly, terrifyingly awful. And what is this going to mean for the communities of people that they're going to target in Italy? And so I think it's that mixture of long-term systemic factors tied in with essentially the decline of the anti-fascist consensus. You know, there's 16, 17-year-old, 18-year-olds now where the Holocaust and the Second World War is like talking to my parents and my grandparents about the Napoleonic period. You know, the Second World War has become increasingly historicized. It's not the touchstone that it once was for certainly younger generations. And I think that partly explains why, you know, the youth vote in parts of the far right vote in Europe is in some places actually a young vote, which is not what it used to be, is because the Holocaust and the Second World War is this historical thing that happened to their great grandparents. It's like talking about the Boer War to people of kind of our generation. And then you throw in the internet and then it's like a firecracker into a swamp.
A lot of what you just mentioned that we've touched on in previous episodes, you know, about, let's say, demand side factors and losers and winners of globalization and neoliberalism and all these things. And we've also touched on cultural backlash, you know, that, you know, you talk about BNP, let's say, focusing on gay men in the 1990s and today on the trans community, you know, so that's also going on at the same time as all these other issues that you mentioned. But you just you know, touched on there at the end, how young people have, you know, maybe think of the Holocaust as we might think of the Boer War or even the Napoleonic Wars, you know, as being in the deep past, you know, not something that they can relate to. And that's partly because time has kind of changed a bit with the internet, I think. And it's something we did touch on a bit with Lars Rensman, how the internet and particularly certain social media apps, their algorithms embrace hostility and conflict. So, you know, how important have technological changes been in facilitating the rise of the far right?
I think they've been fundamental. I'm always kind of staggered how many books are out there and articles are out there that talk about the rise of the far right, and they don't mention the rise of social media and the rise of the internet and what it's done. I think it's done a few things that I think are really important. One is it's significantly lowered the bar of entry into the far right. If you think about what getting active meant for most of the post-war period in terms of becoming far right, you probably had to go to a street stall. You know, in London, you'd go to Brick Lane, or, you know, you'd have to go to a major conurbation and you'd have to get a leaflet and you'd have to sign up, or you'd have to go through the phone book. I spoke to a guy who used to be a far right guy, a fascist in the 80s and 90s. And he said, like, he knew the name of someone in the BNP, and he would ring everyone with that second name in the phone book till he eventually got the right person. There's all of these hurdles to getting involved that you really have to be interested and committed. If you wanted to read Holocaust denial for long periods, you'd have to send off a letter to a book list in America that would send it back. You would then send off a postal order, all these things. The internet has just made the bar to entry so much lower. Nowadays, you can sit anywhere in the entire world, as long as you have an internet connection, and you can read any far-right book that's probably ever been published, or any far-right pamphlet that's ever been published. You can consume and create social media content. You can watch videos, you can make videos, you can interact and engage with far-right people from all over the globe. So it just means that the ease with which one can come across material, and in some cases, unfortunately, because of the failings of social media companies, the ease with which people have been fed the material, even without looking for it, has meant that the bar is much lower. And I think that partly explains why we are seeing high levels of youth radicalization now, because if you were a 15-year-old or a 14-year-old in the 1980s who wanted to get involved in fascist politics and you lived in rural Scotland or rural Ireland, it was pretty hard to work it out. Whereas now, if you have a phone and you can sit there, you can consume content at the touch of a button. So there's that level to it as well. The other thing is, I think it also allows for the kind of, the internet is like synapses. All of the things that make it really positive and exciting and wonderful, the way that we can communicate across borders and, you know, find out all this amazing information, can also be weaponized. And I think it's why so much of what we're seeing in far-right movements, certainly at a street level, for example, they look so familiar wherever you go in the world. You know, whether or not, when I was in Ireland speaking to people that were campaigning against kind of anti-migrant activism on the street, the stuff they were talking about was identical to what we were seeing in the United Kingdom. It was very similar to the stuff that you'd hear on the streets that you're hearing in Germany and Stockholm and Budapest and Warsaw. And it's because these communities are reading each other's information, they're watching each other's videos. It means that there's synapses around which the internet can happen. And then finally, the other thing I think that's really important that the internet's done is it's changed, as well as making it easier for far-right parties, it means that the gatekeepers have disappeared. Again, another thing that's really wonderful about the internet is you don't have to have a major record label to get your music out there. You can just make it and stick it up on Spotify yourself and all that. Traditionally, far-right parties were ostracized from mainstream discourse. It was very hard for them to get on television. It was very hard for them to get on radio. They weren't interviewed in national newspapers, etc. The internet's changed that. It means that far-right figures can reach millions of people, tens of millions of people, in some sad cases, hundreds of millions of people, through the content that they're creating. They can go directly to people. I think about in the UK, groups like people like Tommy Robinson, the anti-Muslim street activist that ran the English Defence League, you know, or Britain First, again, an anti-Muslim movement, you know, that had a million people on Facebook, which was more than most BBC shows get when they were pumping out their content. Whereas you might remember there was huge outrage when Nick Griffin, the former leader of the British National Party, went on Question Time, a TV show in the UK. There was mass outrage because they were saying, why are we letting him on television? Now, of course, he does his show admittedly to dwindling numbers, but he does his show on YouTube each week, and you can, so it means that they can reach millions of people because they don't have those gatekeepers there. It makes things like No Platform, the policy of stopping fascists having platforms, much harder to maintain because they can circumnavigate these things. And even when social media companies have tried to clamp down on it, some of them haven't, like Twitter and Elon Musk, for example. It means that these places can reach millions of people. So putting that all together, I think it's, they are synapses with tactics, money, information are transferred globally by the movement, but it also means they can reach huge numbers of people. But there's very little that, that anyone can kind of do about that to stop it nowadays.
You and several of your colleagues from Hope Not Hate wrote a book entitled The International Alt-Right. Can you explain to listeners what the alt-right is?
I mean, so the alt-right was this movement. Actually, it's a great example. It's kind of, it's a good follow-on from the last question, really, and that was saying, like, what one of the things the internet's done is, as well as helping establish movements that would, you know, national movements that would collaborate with each other, the alt-right is a great example of a movement that emerged out of the internet, which was genuinely transnational, genuinely global in its makeup. It wasn't just a British movement collaborating with an Irish movement, collaborating with a German movement. Its very makeup was like this post-organizational thing, this notion of thousands of individuals all over the world collaborating towards a single cause. And broadly, there was kind of three parts to it. One element of the movement was a very old, from the late 1960s movement called the Nouvelle Droite, which you may have kind of touched on before, this, which talked about a meta-political approach, which broadly means that culture, so politics is downstream of culture. They need to change the debate. And it came out of France, these kind of far-right philosophers there. These ideas became increasingly important in the international far-right and were being picked up by American groups. You then had the traditional far-right and fascist movements, etc. And then on top of that, you had this third element, which was essentially kind of online antagonistic communities, whether or not that was trolling or the meme style, the way that the movement worked. And you put those kind of things together, and broadly, they had a core ideology, which was, it was an international set of groups and individuals primarily operating online, though there were kind of groups that would operate offline or there would be conferences. And together they had a core set of beliefs, right, which was broadly that white identity is under attack from pro-multicultural and liberal elites, what they would call social justice warriors. And together they were, there was united around what they opposed. They were against LGBTQ rights, they were against women's rights, they were against ethnic and religious minority rights. And it was broadly this decentralized network that had a core set of beliefs. And it operated in different ways in different parts of the world, but it was ostensibly a global internet movement that did have conferences, etc., and did have organizations. But it was like a current, if you will, rather than a single formal organization.
You mentioned trolling. Can you tell us a bit about the role of the troll?
It's one of those things that kind of, there was a time when you were like a historian of fascism, you were spending your whole time reading books about dense ideology and, or, you know, and then you start researching trolls and stuff, and it's just, it starts off almost being hard to take seriously, but the impact and the reality of this kind of trolling communities has been really, really pernicious and is really, really serious. Ostensibly, it's the wrapping of, the way I would describe it is it's the wrapping of politics or the wrapping of far-right politics in irony. So it's this notion that it's extraordinarily hostile. It's very, very confrontational in its style. In some ways, of course, it just mimics quite a broad, it doesn't have to be explicitly far-right, of course, trolling. It's a wider internet culture, which is about attacking, mimicking, laughing, ironizing, but broadly hostile behavior towards an individual or target online. But the far right found it extraordinarily useful because it did a couple of things for them. In one sense, it was an extension of things they already believed. They felt like it was a legit. You were allowed to be racist. You were allowed to be misogynistic. You were allowed to be homophobic and transphobic and all these things. But it also gave a back door. It also gave a get out, which was, this is a joke. Don't take this so seriously. You don't understand the internet. The internet has a culture which is ironic, which is confrontational, which is about laughing and joking and attacking, and you can say outrageous things. You know, no more of your gatekeeping. We're going to be free. And it meant that it became much harder to pin down far-right targets because they'd turn around and, you know, they might use a thing, famously Pepe the Frog is now an outdated one, but it was one that was quite important in 2017, this kind of little green frog that would be used, you know, and they would use this green frog at Auschwitz. And when you'd say this is anti-Semitism, their response would always be, you don't understand internet culture. This isn't anti-Semitism. This is a joke. But actually the core message at the core of it was anti-Semitic. So it's this ironic wrapping of far-right politics in irony was what the far-right were attempting to do by using the kind of trolling culture. And it allowed them to attack the people that they wanted to attack online and justify it as saying this is what part of internet culture.
When we were earlier talking about the far-right and modernization, it seems that they were, you know, took advantage of these technological changes a lot more so than the mainstream established parties. And you also show, I think, in your book about the international alt-right, what happens when some of these social media companies actually clamp down on groups. You know, you talked about Tommy Robinson and Nick Griffin having their own kind of outlets, and when that's actually stemmed, it's incredible how their support diminishes because they don't have that many avenues. So it does show you that if there is proper regulation, this can be tackled to a certain extent, although, as you mentioned, things like Twitter and Elon Musk, that there's not always that willingness there. And you could also question a lot of the social media companies in that they want activity conflict, as we mentioned earlier, you know, fits into their algorithms, makes people use these things more than they would otherwise. Just finally, you know, when I was reading in Drums in the Distance, you stated that, quote, when I first got involved in anti-fascist politics back in 2010, it was inconceivable that just a decade later, over 1.9 billion people would live in countries with radical right governments. As of 2020, this included three of the five most populous countries on earth, with the US under then President Donald Trump, Brazil under Bolsonaro, and India under Modi. So you also noted the role of the Law and Justice Party in the then Polish government, Orban's government in Hungary, as well as the radical right's presence in various coalitions around the continent. So since then, you know, Trump and Bolsonaro lost power, Law and Justice Party no longer are in the same kind of ascendancy in Poland. Nevertheless, you know, you've mentioned Giorgia Meloni and her Fratelli d'Italia, for instance, and their popularity. We know that Geert Wilders' party is the most popular in the Netherlands, and that's been confirmed by the European elections. And we know that Trump easily won the Republican nomination for the upcoming US presidency. So it's a difficult question and a sad one in many respects, but are you more optimistic or pessimistic about the position of the far right now than in 2020?
So I work for an organization called Hope Not Hate, right? So I'm always supposed to do the hope bit, but I always forget to do the hope bit. No, I'm not, unfortunately. I mean, there's been victories, right? Of course, Trump lost, you know, Bolsonaro lost. I was lucky enough to be in Brazil when he lost. But it was funny, it didn't feel like a victory in some senses, you know, because Bolsonaro's party still did really well in Sao Paulo and still did really well in Rio. But when the far right is in power, it puts down roots. And I think what we need to start to understand is that it's about what is the direction of travel for the far right, not necessarily just individual results here and there. Law and Justice, yes, they lost in Poland, and they came, but you know, in the European election they came second, and Confederation came third. So it's about taking a longer term view of it, as I say, maybe a 20-year view or a 30-year view. And while it is an uneven rise, and there are victories and losses, there is an upward trajectory of the far right, and I think that's what we need to be concerned about, and that's what we need to be watching. Is the slow death of liberal democracy. It's not going to be a rapid, it's not going to be a collapse, it's not going to be jackboots marching down the roads like the 1930s. It's going to be a slow erosion of liberal democratic institutions, norms and principles to the point where we will probably end up with illiberal democracies increasingly taking their place. And then we can throw in Russia and China, etc. But maybe that's another podcast. So that we should, of course, take heart from the victories like Poland and Trump's loss and Bolsonaro's loss and Modi's reduced victory just recently in India. And we should say, yeah, it was great. Sweden Democrats last week had the very first time in their history their vote went down. But this is kind of thin gruel, right? This is actually, in some senses, a recognition of how normal this now feels. That we are saying, isn't it good news that a party that had its roots in explicit Nazism not that long ago, it goes down slightly in the votes, but doesn't lose any seats in Sweden. And we're saying, well, this is good news. And we're taking heart from what's happened in Denmark and Finland, where the vote wasn't quite as bad. And people are taking heart from Liga in Italy doing less bad, despite the fact that Meloni's and Brozovic have doubled their votes. I think complacency is going to be our enemy with this. And it's not about doomsaying and saying that, you know, liberal democracy is about to collapse, you know, fascism is about to return. That's not going to be helpful either, because that also ends up having a gravitational pull on the centre of our politics, and mainstream parties turn around and say, well, we need to listen to the will of the people and run right on immigration. That's unhelpful as well. And there is pockets of light. I mean, we have to also remember turnout is always important in these things. You know, even in the European elections and even in the elections where the far right win, almost never is it the far right party that has a majority of the population. They have a winning minority, if you will. So even in the places where they do get over 50%, they're usually about a quarter of the population, which means that those people that are not voting for the far right in all of these countries, we remain in a massive majority, usually. And there's a lot of hope in that. The question then is, we only lose these battles if we decide not to fight them. And that's where I think the hope lies, is if we, those parties and groups and individuals that, if we prioritise fighting and destroying the far right and the far right politics, we will win, because we are in a massive majority here. And if we start to deal with the material needs of the people that are susceptible to that politics, we will win. So there's loads of optimism there. But currently, I just don't see that happening, which is where the pessimism creeps back in. And I think, you know, we could be in a situation without sounding too apocalyptic in the next 5 years where Trump, you know, may well win the White House back. Modi's obviously kept his seat. There's a chance that France will be run by Le Pen or National Rally. Meloni in Italy, AfD have got elections. There's elections in the eastern states of Germany in September. AfD are polling on 30%. There'll be almost nowhere in Europe where the far right or radical right are not in electoral or parliamentary chambers across the continent. What does Europe look like in 10 years' time, 20 years' time? We could have most major European countries being run by far right governments. These are things that were incomprehensible just 10 years ago. And already now we seem feel quite normal. And so I don't want to say, I want to be optimistic, but I think if we don't start to do things, the situation is extraordinarily serious. The pillars of liberal democracy are wobbling. It's not about Nazism, is not about to return, but illiberal democracy may be able to supplant liberal democracy. And so no, is the short answer. I don't feel particularly optimistic, but so far the good news is everywhere we have fought, we've won. And so if we keep fighting and we start to fight more, then I'm convinced we will win.
Okay, thanks, Joe. I know you ended on a mixed note. You know, there's pessimism and optimism, but I do feel, let's say, the work of Hope Not Hate, the fact that it's sustained itself, you know, that it didn't, let's say, with the end of the BNP or the demise of the BNP, it didn't finish its work. This is a fight that has to go on, that continues to go on. And as you say, if you don't fight, you can't win. So I think this is perhaps a message of hope for the future. But I think you're also correct in saying, you know, the trajectory is such that, you know, the fact that, as we mentioned maybe before we recorded, that, you know, the reaction to the European elections is like, oh, the far right didn't win as much as we thought. You know, it still gained, but we thought it was going to be a collapse of the centre, but that hasn't emerged yet. But, you know, what you're saying about in 10 or 20 years' time is a real warning that we have to keep fighting in the future. But thanks so much for taking the time out, Joe. Really informative, and also for providing such a historical swap from the late 1940s until today.
No, thanks for having us. It was good fun.
You can find a huge range of podcasts and videos showcasing historical research on our website, historyhub.ie. You can also follow us on various social media, and if you want to get in contact with us about the series, please email info@historyhub.ie.